turn up in relation to St. Angela's property?
She looked over Kirby's desk and rolled her eyes at his mess. He hastily stuffed a Happy Meal box down at his feet, a guilty slant on his lips.
I hadn't time yet, he quickly added. What am I looking for?
If I knew that, I wouldn't be asking you to look, would I?
A hint, maybe.
You're a detective. Start detecting. Under his breath, Kirby cursed every woman he ever knew.
Okay, Lottie relented.
Find all you can on Tom Ricard's involvement with St. Angela's. She spent another 2 hours checking all their reports to date. Came up with nothing. It didn't dampen her high spirits. She sensed she might be near the kernel of the case. She googled St. Angela's. A photograph in last February's Midland Examiner caught her attention. Bishop Terence Connor handing over the keys to Tom Ricard of Ricard Construction. The byline informed her the property was to be developed as a hotel and golf course, subject to planning permission. Jumping up, she went looking for Boyd and found him in the coffee cupboard boiling the kettle.
"Do you fancy a drive?" she asked.
"Where to?"
"You ask too many questions. Come on."
The day had been long and now the moon curved a shimmering light through the sky. Boyd drove. Lottie was bone weary. She directed him onto the old road out of town.
"I hope you don't expect me to visit the cemetery in the dark," Boyd said.
"Coward. Turn left here." He swung up a narrow tree-lined road and stopped at the gated entrance to St. Angela's.
"Intimidating looking place," Boyd said, switching off the engine.
Lottie exited the car. The gate was open, but she wanted to walk. The yellow neon from the road lamps provided a dim light. A four-story building, silhouetted under the moon, stood 200 yards at the end of the winding tree-lined avenue. Lottie looked up. A cold streak shimmied down her spine. She'd seen this place in the distance many times before. It was visible from the cemetery. But now she couldn't halt the disquiet it was causing her. Trying to calm her brain, she began counting the windows. 16 along the top floor. Boyd stood beside her.
"Why are we staring at this building in the dark?"
"We now know St. Angela's is the subject of a Tom Ricard planning application," Lottie said, shielding herself behind Boyd, deflecting the sharp breeze wrestling with the branches above their heads.
"So?"
"James Brown phoned Tom Ricard on the evening he was murdered. Ricard hasn't provided us with a solid alibi." She paused and considered what Ricard could gain from murder. According to Bea Walsh, Brown and Sullivan were dealing with the planning file, which appeared to be missing. Ricard bought St. Angela's from Bishop Connor, who now has a murdered priest. And this is the place, the institution, where the young Susan, then known as Sally, was abandoned, along with her newborn baby. Boyd remained silent.
"Well?"
Lottie asked.
"I don't like that Tom Ricard fella," he said, shoving his hands deep into his coat pockets.
"Is that all you have to say?"
"At the moment, yes. And I'm freezing. Come on, mad woman."
He headed to the car. She stepped forward a few paces. A gust of wind echoed around her, causing another shiver to scuttle up her spine. She tried to shrug it away, along with the feeling of the old dark memory stirring within her. Her whole body trembled. She walked after Boyd.
"What's up?" Boyd asked, looking back over his shoulder.
"It's nothing. Go start the car." Once more, she stared up at the buildings as Boyd jumped into the car and switched on the engine. Fixing her gaze, she wondered if St. Angela's had in fact anything to do with 2, possibly 3 murders. She noticed an alcove in the center of the roof, a round construction housing a concrete statue. She squinted, but the night was too dark to figure it out. She'd have to see it in daylight. She strolled back to the car, away from St. Angela's, shielding its ghosts behind shadows.
"Tomorrow, let's haul in Tom Ricard's arse," she said, sitting in beside Boyd, "and turn up the heater."
Chapter 45.
Fancy a bite to eat? Boyd asked, idling the engine outside the station.
No thanks, Lottie said.
Come on. It's after 9 o'clock and I haven't eaten since I don't know when. I'd love an Indian.
He did a U-turn and drove down Main Street. The town was deserted.
Jesus, Boyd. If Corrigan saw what you just did.
No chance of him seeing me.
Why not? He's at a charity dance in the Park Hotel. The golf ball.
You're joking.
I'm serious.
He has a nerve.
Why?
We're in the middle of 3 major investigations and he's putting himself out there at some fancy gig.
The media will have a field day.
Boyd parked the car on a double yellow line outside Sagar's Indian restaurant as snow started to fall.
I should go home and feed my children, or at least bring them a takeaway, Lottie protested.
They're not kittens.
They can feed themselves. They haven't died of starvation so far, Boyd said.
He had a point, she surmised. They got out of the car and climbed the stairs to the first floor restaurant. They were the only customers. Soft music, the single sound shaking the stillness. Dull wall lights muted the scarlet decor. To some it might be considered romantic, but it reminded Lottie of a room dressed for Halloween. She selected a table by the window, where she could look out over the street below while avoiding Boyd's eyes. For a moment she idly watched the snowflakes melting against the windowpane.
I need to use the bathroom, she said, standing up.
You can order for me. She peed, washed her hands, and hurriedly swiped Katie's lipstick over her pout.
Katie.
Tackling the source of her weed habit was still on her to-do list, a list which was growing by the day. She checked to see if her T-shirt was clean enough to remove her jacket.
It would have to do.
I ordered, said Boyd, as she sat down again.
I'm sorry.
For what?
You know, ringing you when I was drunk the other night.
I don't mind.
He busied himself with the wine menu. I know you don't. That's the problem, said Lottie.
Wasn't a problem for me, said Boyd. But...
But what?
I would like a call some night when you're sober.
The waiter brought over a bottle of sparkling water and poured it into tumblers.
Order wine for yourself, said Lottie. I'll drive your car home for you.
You sure? I wouldn't say it otherwise.
Boyd indicated a bottle of the house red to the waiter.
That didn't take much persuading, Lottie said, as they lapsed into another silence, both looking out the window.
Abandoning the outside view, she studied him. He was intent on the traffic below. She had to admit he was awkwardly handsome. His severe jawline accentuated his brown eyes, and when they caught the light, they shimmered. A little piece of her yearned to delve beneath the surface of what made Mark Boyd tick, but another part of her was afraid of what she might discover about herself if she grew too close to him. Their starter arrived.
I hope it's not too spicy, said Boyd.
I could do with a little spice in my life, said Lottie, sniffing the aroma.
I offered.
I know.
You declined.
I know, repeated Lottie, ladling mint chutney onto a chapati. They ate in silence.
Do you want to talk about the case or will we enjoy the silence? Boyd asked as the waiter cleared the plates away.
Tom Ricard is in this up to his neck.
The only evidence to support that theory is one phone call from James Brown, which, I might add, he denies having received.
We can prove he received it.
Agreed, but we'll never know what they talked about. Brown could have been telling him Susan Sullivan was dead, said Lottie. Ricard had to have known them from the council. He'd probably dealt with them over the planning application.
Okay, said Boyd. In theory, we can infer he knew Brown and Sullivan.
But why kill them?
I don't know, but he's a multimillionaire. He owns at least 4 cars. It could have been his money popping in and out of our victims' accounts.
She looked at Boyd.
Why, though?
Might not have been him. Granted,
He had an application in for developing St. Angela's, but he must have dozens of applications all over the country. Is this one any different? Is there something there to murder for?
Let's recap, Lottie said. The first two victims we discovered had secrets. James Brown was having it off with a younger man and Susan Sullivan was dying of cancer and, aged 11 or 12, she'd had a baby and was incarcerated in St. Angela's. Plus, she changed her name. Was she trying to exercise her past? The property, bought by Tom Ricard from Bishop Connor, is now subject to a planning application to build a multi-million euro hotel, golf course or whatever. Lottie sipped her water. Two of the victims who worked on that file have a similar tattoo on their legs, not to mention the two grand in Susan's freezer, and hundreds of newspapers stacked to high heaven in her sitting room. That's what we have so far. Lottie took a breath. She'd been talking too fast. Boyd knew all of this.
And the dead priest in Brown's back garden, don't forget him, he said.
We have bodies, a load of questions and feck all answers, Lottie said. She pulled at the cuff of her t-shirt, picked a stray thread and watched it unravel. I'm beginning to feel like the proverbial broken record. The waiter arrived and placed their main course in silver bowls on the table. Chicken korma aroma infused the air with coconut. Eat and enjoy, Lottie said. She relaxed as they ate. With their plates cleared away, she ordered a green tea. Boyd poured the last of his wine and looked outside.
Drink up, Lottie said.
We have a 6 a.m. case conference with Superintendent Corrigan.
He'll have some head in him.
Pot and kettle spring to mind, said Lottie with a smile.
There, he said. Your face lights up when you decide to curve those fascinating lips upwards.
She laughed, feeling lightheaded. He finished his wine. They split the bill and left. Lottie drove Boyd to his apartment, parked the car, handed him the keys, and walked him to the door. The heavy snow had turned to light flakes.
Thanks for the meal.
I think I needed the time out, Lottie said.
Come in for a coffee?
Coffee keeps me awake all night.
Good,
Boyd smirked.
I better get home.
She lingered a moment. He caressed her cheek, tracing an imaginary line from her eye to her mouth.
Don't, Lottie said.
Why not?
You liked it the other night, remember?
I don't like being reminded of things I don't remember doing while in a state of unremembrance.
Lottie turned her head away.
That's not a word.
I don't care anymore.
That's what you said the other night too.
You're a sadistic bastard, Mac Boyd.
She was laughing.
I want you, he said, moving his hand behind her neck, up into her hair.
I know you do. His fingers drew little circles at the base of her hairline. He bent his head to hers and kissed her on the lips. She tasted wine and spices, felt a flutter in the pit of her stomach and, her hands still in her pockets, allowed herself a moment of pleasure.
Then she stopped him. I'm sorry, she said, dropping her head.
Don't be.
Dear God, Lottie, don't be sorry.
He lifted her chin with a finger.
I have to go, she said.
I understand. He placed a chaste kiss on her lips.
You should have got stitches on that nose. You'll have a scar.
He traced one final line on her cheek, caressing the bruise beneath her eye, and she felt the softness of his sigh on her hair before he turned his key in the lock, let himself in and closed the door. She knew he was standing in there, behind the door, waiting for her to put her finger on the bell. She could easily do it, ring the bell, but she didn't. She pulled her hood up and walked home, her face upturned, catching the gentle flakes. Chapter 46. The town was so quiet as he drove home that he was surprised to see a woman walking alone through the snow.
He almost stopped to offer a lift when she raised her head and her face was highlighted under the streetlight. Detective Inspector Lottie Parker. He kept driving for a few minutes before pulling in at a closed garage. He hadn't had too much to drink, but all the same, if a patrol car was cruising around, he was sure he was over the drink drive limit. Looking in his rearview mirror, he saw her turn up a secluded avenue. "So that's where you live," he thought. "Good to know these things. Never know when I might have to pay you a visit," he said, and then realized he was talking aloud. What was happening to him? "Go home and have a proper drink," he told himself, and think about the beautiful specimen of a boy he had seen that morning. Switching on the engine, he put the car in gear and pulled out onto the snow-covered road, wondering how long just thinking would suffice before he needed to do something.
Chapter 47. "Is she the one?"
Melanie Ricard was drunk. She kicked off her high heels. Tom Ricard watched them slide across the marble kitchen floor.
"What one?" he asked.
"The bitch you're fucking."
"What are you talking about?" he asked quietly. You did not shout when Melanie was shouting.
"Don't act innocent with me," she mocked. "Is she the one you fuck and then come home smelling of wild berries and jasmine? Joe fucking Malone perfume. I'm not stupid, you prick."
"You're drunk," he said, which was the wrong thing to say to a drunk and incensed Melanie. She screamed and banged her fists on the counter before returning to a dangerous calm. "I'm not blind," she said. "Your eyes were buried down her dress, almost at her navel." He said nothing. He could not deny that he had ogled the beautiful blonde sitting across the table from him, wanted to reach out and run his hands along her neck, to push his lips against hers, like he had done last night. He had cursed himself for allowing Melanie to browbeat him into attending the golf ball. He knew she was going to be there, with her mousy husband. Perhaps, subconsciously, he really did want to be there, to compare her exquisiteness to Melanie's rapidly disappearing attractiveness. But having to sit next to Superintendent Corrigan made for an awkward evening, so he'd plied him with brandy. Bunch of drunks, the lot of them, he thought, and Melanie was the worst of all. He had escaped with her, as early as he could. "I wouldn't touch her with a barge pole," he said. "So that's what was trying to break out of your trousers. Well, fuck you, Tom, and the horse you rode in on." She grabbed a bottle of Cabernet. He thought she was going to throw it at him, but she uncorked it, quicker than she would have if sober, pulled a glass from the cabinet, and strode in her bare feet out of the kitchen to the sitting room, where she promptly fell asleep in an oversized armchair. He stood in the middle of the frigid room and wondered where it had all gone wrong. He hated her. In that instant, he could strangle her.
Chapter 48.
Facebook. Lottie logged in. She listened to the hum of the refrigerator and the murmur of the television show Sean and Chloe were watching in the sitting room. Katie was out, again. Probably with Jason Ricard. As she sipped a glass of water, sitting in her kitchen armchair, a friend request popped up. She idly tapped the icon. Father Joe's picture appeared. She put down the glass and uncurled her legs, hit the accept tab. The chat box sprang up. He was online.
"Hi. Where are you?"
"Rome."
"What are you doing there?"
"You're a murder suspect."
"Very funny.
Superintendent Corrigan will have a fit. Your bishop will have a fit. I hope to be back before either misses me."
"How do you propose to manage that?"
"I said my mother was ill and had to visit her in Wexford."
"What are you doing in Rome anyway?"
"Being an amateur detective."
"You're funny.
Do you know we found another body? I heard it on the news.
Do you know who it is?
No. Who?
Father Angelotti.
There was no reply for some time, but the application showed he was active.
Then he replied.
That's terrible. I don't understand.
Neither do I. Can you see if anyone in Rome knows why he was here?
I'll ask around. Lottie?
What?
Remember you asked if I could find out anything about St. Angela's records?
Yes.
I looked up our archive, but there was nothing online. The records are in hard copy.
Where?
Normally records like this are archived by each diocese. But I cross-checked, thinking St. Angela's might have been forwarded to the Dublin Archdiocese, which is normal procedure.
And?
I talked to the archivist there. They had the records at one time, but he said that St. Angela's records were transferred to Rome.
By who?
Why?
That's not normal, is it?
Not normal, no. I don't know who requested the transfer, and I've never come across this before. But I'm going to find out what I can.
When were they moved?
Don't know that either. I'll check. I hope you don't get in trouble.
I won't.
I hope I find something interesting.
Thank you.
And I'll try to find out if anyone knows anything about Father Angelotti.
Thank you, Father Joe.
Joe.
Okay.
Joe.
Good night.
Ciao. As the Italians say. They both signed off.
Rome.
Lottie wondered what was going on.
Why move St. Angela's records if that wasn't normal procedure?
She took an A4 notepad from Sean's school bag and a pen. At the kitchen table she wrote down all she knew so far. None of it made sense. She looked at the names, wondering if they were connected or if it were all a random mess. The front door opened and shut.
"Where are you coming from at this hour of the night?"
Lottie asked, as Katie sauntered into the kitchen, taking off her damp jacket.
"What's that?"
Katie asked, looking at the pages strewn on the table.
"Work,"
Lottie said.
"I figured that.
Why have you Jason's dad's name written there?"
"So, now I do know him?"
Lottie studied her eldest daughter. Her eyes, though round with thick black eyeliner, were clear.
"Jason told me you called to his house this morning."
"Where were you?"
"In his room. I had to stay there because there was some business meeting going on downstairs."
The little shit Jason had lied.
"Who was at this meeting?" asked Lottie.
"How do I know? I was confined to barracks, as Dad used to say when he sent me to my room."
Katie opened the fridge door and scanned its meagre contents.
"Why were you there, anyway?"
"Because I want to get to the bottom of this weed thing. It's serious, Katie."
"Mother, I'm not a child!"
"You're my child, and I'm not going to have you dying in some doorway with a needle in your arm. And I can guarantee Jason Rickard will run a million miles from you when he loses interest."
"Whatever. I'm going to bed,"
she said, pulling the wrapper off a cheese string.
"Did you eat today?"
Katie waved the cheese from the fridge at her and hurried out of the room before Lottie could further admonish her.
Sitting at the table, she mulled over Tom Rickard and who else might have been at the meeting. Why did he have to conduct business at his house? He had a perfectly grand office in the centre of town. Was something underhand being discussed? Gathering up the pages, she put them in her bag and sat on her armchair with her legs curled up. Closing her eyes, she fell into a fitful sleep and dreamt about black crows circling a bleeding statue of a woman with a blue nylon rope tight around her neck. One of the crows swooped low, stabbed its feathery body into a cot, before flying away with a squealing baby wedged in its beak. Lottie awoke suddenly, a cold sweat sending rivulets between her breasts. 2nd of January, 1975. Sally saw the boy sitting in the window, as she followed the nun up the steps and through the door to the sound of the car leaving her behind. The hallway was cold, and the floor threw up a wax-polished smell. Panic threatened to overwhelm her as the nun disappeared down a corridor. With her baby. A door banged and she followed the echo. A baby cried, and she wondered if she would be able to recognize the sound of her own child, and wasn't at all sure that she could. She inched along, stepping on the wooden patterns until the floor changed to multicolored mosaics. She paused outside a door before turning the handle. Her knickers were sopping, the blood trickling down her legs staining her white knee socks red. Her tiny breasts were sore and leaking. She wanted to crawl up in her own bed and die. She twisted the handle and opened the door. Three rows of iron-barred cribs, five to a line and a baby in each. The nun stood in the center of the room and turned, casting her arms wide. Sally wondered which cot held her baby. They looked like dolls. Little dolls in cages.
"These are the devil's work. Children of sin, spawn of Satan," the nun snarled.
Sally felt her knees buckle and blood ooze between her legs. The black robe swished towards her, smelling like a drawer in her dead granny's wardrobe. Most of the nuns in her school wore shorter skirts, and some even ventured to show a lock of hair. This one, shrouded in old-style robes, with a stained white cotton apron tied at the waist, was tall, and her transparent skin wore a washed-out, threatening face. "Where is my baby?" Sally asked, anxiously looking along a row of cots, straining to see behind the nun. All the babies were quiet now, some asleep, others awake, their little eyes pleading towards the cracked ceiling.
"It is not yours any more," the nun said. "They all belong to the devil."
Sally gathered her strength, and with fear fueling her momentum, she pushed past the nun, ran to the end of the room and back. Tears blinded her. Frantically, she searched for her baby. But which one was hers? "Where's my baby?" she cried. "Tell me!" The room began to swirl. The stink of dirty nappies and sour milk clogged her nose. Babies began to wail, disturbed by her scream. As she hit the floor, she saw the blue and white statue at the end of the room. The Virgin Mary, a serpent wrapped around her swollen belly, choking the life from the infant before it was even born. Day 6, 4th of January, 2015. Chapter 49. The 6 a.m. conference was seriously in need of the hair of the dog. Superintendent Corrigan had a hangover. Boyd had a hangover. Kirby had a hangover. Lottie and Maria Lynch were caught in the crossfire. Once she had dragged herself from the kitchen armchair to bed, Lottie's night had been filled with more nightmares. She'd woken up at 5, drenched in sweat. She was glad of the early morning briefing, needing something to concentrate on, to banish the night terrors. Outlining the progress they'd made, she wished that today might see more success. And pigs might fly. She looked at Corrigan, dubiously. "I'm going to have a chat with Tom Ricard today," she said.
"A chat?"
Corrigan bellowed, then winced and lowered his voice.
"What kind of chat?"
"I want to see what information I can discover about his development of St. Angelus. It's all we have to go on. It might be a blind alley, but we have to pursue it."
"Don't go charging down any feckin' alleys like a proverbial bull in a china shop."
"He's an acquaintance of mine.
Talked with him last night, I did. Grand man. I don't want him on the phone again yelling about you harassing him. Especially not today."
He stroked his bald head, increasing its sheen. "Of course." Lottie was in no mood for arguments either. The duty sergeant thrust his head around the door. We hauled in a drunk last night. He's awake now, shouting the place down. I think you need to hear him, Inspector.
I'm in the middle of a case conference.
He says he knew Susan Sullivan.
Right, said Lottie, gathering up her papers. Put him in an interview room, and I'll be there straight away.
He's a bit worse for wear, the sergeant warned.
Aren't we all? Said Kirby.
Every pair of eyes in the room turned to him. Kirby dropped his head. I'm on my way, said Lottie.
The air reeked of soft, rotting onions. Lottie's stomach heaved, and she attempted to stem the rise of bile. Boyd sat beside her, and she knew he was itching to light a cigarette. She looked across the table at the drunk and checked his name on the charge sheet. Patrick O'Malley was a mess. His face was a map of pulsating pimples, and he continuously licked with a swollen tongue, cold sores and cracked lips. His quaking hands sprouted long crooked nails stuffed with the remnants of whatever he'd eaten last, were sheathed in fingerless gloves. An old woolen coat reminded Lottie of one her father had worn, hung over at least two faded hoodies. Here is a man, she thought, who wears his journey through life, not only on his clothes, but in his eyes.
Mr. O'Malley, she said, I appreciate you talking to us. You know your rights, and we are recording this interview.
He averted his eyes, glancing longingly at the door, then lowered his head.
Would you like a cup of tea? She asked.
He looked up slowly from under sticky eyelids, and she realized his trembles were not only fueled by alcohol. He was terrified of authority.
No, ma'am, Inspector, O'Malley said at last, his voice low and cracked. I'll be grand.
If you're sure.
Yeah.
You had a bit of a rough night?
Yeah, I did, he said, furtively looking around the small room.
Had a few of them myself recently, Lottie said. O'Malley laughed hoarsely. Lottie decided he was now reasonably relaxed for her to find out what he'd been roaring about in the holding cell.
You mentioned to my colleagues that you knew Susan Sullivan. Is there something you want to tell me?
You could say that, he said.
Then again, you might not.
Lottie swallowed a sigh, hoping this wasn't going to be one of those cryptic interviews resulting from the ramblings of a drunken mind. She might puke all over him before they'd finished. She wondered how Boyd was coping, but dared not look at him.
Wasn't I only lying in the doorway of Carey's electrical shop, trying to keep warm, mind? It's hard in this weather with only this old coat and a few bits of cardboard. But I suppose you wouldn't have to think about that, Inspector, would you?
Lottie shook her head.
Didn't think so. Fine woman like yourself. I'm sure you have a man to keep you warm at night.
O'Malley chuckled, immediately curling up in a coughing fit. Yellow phlegm coated his lips.
Are you all right?
Lottie looked around for tissues, found a box behind her and offered it to him. He pulled out a bunch, stuffed them in his pockets, without cleaning his mouth.
I'll get you water, Boyd said, and escaped to fetch it. I've had this cold, you see. Can't get rid of it.
He paused while his lungs rattled loudly in his chest. Boyd returned with two plastic cups and handed one to O'Malley. He drank it in one thirsty gulp.
Here, have mine, Boyd said, sliding it over.
Thank you, sir, O'Malley said and lowered his head.
Go ahead, Mr. O'Malley, Lottie said. You have something to tell me.
What was I saying?
He looked from Lottie to Boyd, as if he were trying to remember where he was. Not only where he was in the conversation, but where he actually was in reality.
Lottie fought to control her impatience.
You were outside Carey's, she coaxed.
Having a drop of wine before your lot hauled me in here. Minding my own business, I was.
I wasn't always a drunk or homeless, you know, like. Then again, maybe I was.
He puckered up his face.
Jesus, he was going to cry.
Lottie stole a glance at Boyd, but he was staring at a point on the wall above the man's head.
You must be very busy with all these martyrs, Inspector. Don't want to be wasting your time.
He paused, allowing another fit of coughing to pass. I'll choke him myself, thought Lottie, but she smiled warmly, easing the way for him to speak up.
I saw the news on the television in the shop window. The other night, you know, like, couldn't hear it, only saw the pictures. Her photograph was on it.
Whose photograph? Lottie prompted.
I knew her.
Who?
Sally used to bring the soup around at night, to all of us sleeping rough. She was one of the few people who was nice to me.
He stopped talking, closed his eyes and lowered his head, his chin resting on his chest. Sally. Did he mean Susan? If so, delivering soup to the homeless was new information. Lottie wrote it down.
This soup kitchen. Tell me about it.
O'Malley choked up with a cough. After a moment, he said,
That's all there's to tell. She came with the old woman every night.
Tears glistened at the corners of his yellowing eyes.
Who was this old woman?
O'Malley shrugged without a word.
So this Sally you're talking about was Susan Sullivan, Lottie said. Used to be called Sally, before she was Susan,
O'Malley said.
I remembered her, from back then, you see. The first night she brought me the soup. I looked up into her eyes. I saw that look in them.
He scratched at the table with the dirty nail.
The fear. We all had it. When we were kids, not more than 12 years old. In St. Angela's.
Lottie locked eyes with Boyd.
St. Angela's.
2nd of January, 1975. That evening he saw the girl at tea. The refectory was loud and smelly. She was sitting at a table with Sister Immaculata and two other boys. Patrick wanted to find out more about her, so he bounded down between two rows of chairs and slid to a stop behind them.
Sit, Patrick. You make me nervous, said Sister Immaculata.
He sat in noisily beside them.
This is Sally. She's staying here with us for a while. I want you to make her feel at home.
I hate fucking home, Sally said.
Tears streaked dry on her cheeks.
Dear God in heaven, we do not allow such profanity. You will be punished. But first you must eat, said Sister Immaculata, picking up her fork with a bony hand.
Patrick looked at his plate of scrambled eggs and the slice of bread with the hard 2-inch crust. Grabbing for his glass, he knocked it and the milk spilled out across his plate. It saturated the bread and watered the eggs into a runny soup. Sister Immaculata drew back her arm and hit him hard across the top of his head. Sally jumped.
You can have mine, she said. I don't like eggs.
She pushed her plate towards him.
You stupid boy, the nun screamed.
He smirked, insolence plastered on his face. His eyes twinkled devilment. He turned and smiled at Sally. She stared at him wide-eyed, open-mouthed. The nun hit him again. Sister Teresa hurried down between the tables. She took Patrick by the hand and dragged him away from Sister Immaculata's tyranny. He kept looking behind him on the hurried trek from the crowded room, his eyes locked on Sally's the whole way.
No one ever showed me much kindness before Sally arrived, O'Malley said. She didn't mix with the others, so me and her became friends. And then, all these years later, when she was giving out the soup, she used to have little chats with me.
He tightened his cracked lips into a line.
I should say nothing.
You can tell me, Lottie urged. Please go on.
I suppose I can. It won't make much difference now the two of them are dead.
What two? Who are you talking about?
She told me she worked with James Brown. And now he's dead too.
Did you know him?
Yeah. He used to be in St. Angela's with us.
Lottie stared at him, then turned to Boyd, who had quickly straightened up. This was good. The link between Susan and James they'd been hankering after.
James Brown was in St. Angela's? She asked incredulously.
Isn't that what I'm after telling you?
I didn't know that.
Lottie felt her jaw drop. She thought of the tattoo on the victim's legs. James and Susan had similar marks on the inside of their legs.
Like a crude tattoo?
Do you know anything about that?
O'Malley said nothing.
Was it something to do with St. Angela's?
You could say that, he said eventually.
What does it mean? Lottie pressed.
I don't know.
His face closed up.
Did they get the tattoos when they were in St. Angela's?
Yeah.
Lottie thought for a moment.
Do you have one?
O'Malley stared at her, as if he was deciding whether to tell her or not. He said,
I do, Inspector, I do.
So what is it all about?
He licked his lips and shook his head.
Can't remember.
He was lying, but Lottie didn't press it, afraid he might clam up totally. She wanted to hear more about St. Angela's.
Tell me about Susan and James.
We tagged along together, the three of us, in St. Angela's.
He smiled.
We were friends with another lad too.
I can't remember his name.
Do you know, a lot of them changed their names when they got out. I couldn't be bothered.
James neither, I suppose. How long was Susan in there? She asked. He looked confused.
In St. Angela's, she added.
I don't know. It could have been a year. It could have been more or less. To tell you the truth, I don't even know how long I was there.
What did you do all day in St. Angela's? Asked Lottie, scribbling notes.
We went to school in the mornings after Mass. In autumn, we picked apples.
Apples?
Lottie dipped her chin and raised her eyes.
The nuns made apple jelly.
To eat?
To sell, said O'Malley.
There was an orchard there. We used to pick the fallen apples off the ground. If you got punished for something, you had to pluck the maggots and flies out of the mushy ones.
Bad luck if you were afraid of maggots,
O'Malley said with a short laugh, but Lottie noted his eyes were deathly serious.
Apple jelly, mused Lottie, remembering the glass jars, cloth lids held in place with rubber bands on the breakfast table in front of her mother.
Yes, Inspector, said O'Malley. I remember the year Sally arrived. That was a bumper year for apples.
Not a good one for us, though. August 1975.
Sort through that basket of apples, Master Brown, the tall priest said, pointing to a bruised pile of fruit.
Please, Father, I don't like worms. Don't make me do it, said James.
The priest stretched to his full height. The boy cowered as if expecting a slap.
Leave him alone, said Sally.
Patrick stood beside Sally and another boy called Brian. She had an apple in her hand. It was bruised and black. Patrick thought she might throw it at the priest.
A bastard.
That's what Father Conn was. They all knew it. They were all afraid of him. Patrick watched warily as Father Conn stepped towards James and extended his hands into the basket. He plucked an apple, scrutinized it and threw it back. He took out another. This one was almost in mush, a maggot sucking on the flesh. He thrust the fruit towards the boy. James kept his trembling arm wedged to his side.
Eat it,
the priest shouted, shoving the apple under the boy's nose.
Eat.
Don't make him do it,
Sally cried.
You shut your mouth, the priest said.
Patrick gripped Sally's arm. There was no point in them all getting punished.
I said, eat!
James held out his hand but was barely able to hold the apple. His fingers were white to the wrists. He dropped it, turned and ran.
This is your fault, said the priest, grabbing Sally's hair.
She screamed. Patrick froze in his shoes. James reached the end of the orchard and shrunk into the brick wall. The priest grabbed Brian by the arm.
You will take Brown's punishment.
Then he pulled Sally towards him.
Girl, get that apple and make Brian eat every last morsel.
His voice was a sinister whisper.
I'll be watching.
Whatever was in his eyes, Patrick saw it terrify Sally into silence. She held the apple to Brian's mouth. The boy shrieked.
Please,
Sally said, pleading with Brian, tears flowing down her face.
No,
Brian screamed. She shoved the apple into his open mouth. The priest pulled tighter on her hair. James ran back up towards them. Patrick stood motionless.
Again, Father Conn said. Again!
Sally pushed the apple into the boy's mouth, and a black worm wriggled at the corner of his teeth. Her eyes widened in horror. She dropped her hand and the fruit lodged in the boy's mouth, stifling his screams. Patrick stood still as Sally turned to him, pleading. But he couldn't move. O'Malley's eyes were closed, deep in his reminiscences.
That's horrific, Lottie said.
Her skin crawled from the images he'd painted and she clenched her fist. Who was this Father Conn? She looked at the name she'd written.
A bollocks, that's who,
O'Malley said, rage flaring his eyes wide open.
A scourge, a fucking plague,
he paused.
Sorry for the language, Inspector.
Do you know his full name?
Only knew him as Father Conn.
Was this Brian, the friend you mentioned? O'Malley laughed.
Brian was no friend of ours, Inspector.
And you don't know his full name either?
No, ma'am.
He sat in silence for a moment. When he spoke, his voice was a painful, creaking sound.
Dear God, Lottie thought, had he more to tell?
Sally and James, O'Malley said. They weren't the first to be killed, mind. Lottie locked eyes with him, while he dredged up another memory from the depths of his being. August, 1975. Patrick heard Sister Teresa screaming. Then he heard the commotion. Nuns running up and down the corridors, children rushing out of their rooms, everyone wondering what was going on. A baby was missing from the nursery. Whose baby? Patrick felt a terrible fear tie his chest into a knot. He hoped it wasn't Sally's 8-month-old tot. Not that Sally was ever allowed into the nursery to visit. The nuns saw to that. Everyone searched for hours, adults and children, until they found the baby nestled in a basket underneath an apple tree, surrounded by fresh, smooth-skinned apples. The cord from a boy's pajama bottoms was wrapped tight around the tiny neck. The children stood huddled together as a weeping Sister Teresa clutched the chalk-white, doll-like body to her chest. She swept slowly through the hushed crowd, which spread apart like the Red Sea from Moses. As they watched the nun walk up the steps, Patrick held one of Sally's hands and James held the other.
Jeepers creepers, said James.
Crap, said Patrick.
Is it my baby?
Asked Sally. No one let her see the body. No one told Sally anything. Patrick squeezed her hand. She squeezed his back. And the two boys led her inside.
Were the Gardaí called in?
Lottie asked O'Malley.
Are you mad or what?
He said, his tongue flicking in and out of his mouth as if searching for his cold sores. Herded into the hall like animals we were. Told us it was a tragic accident, so they did. Liars! And we were frightened enough to keep our mouths shut.
What happened after that?
Lottie asked, a little too loudly, unable to mask her disbelief. They buried the kid under one of them apple trees. And Sally? She convinced herself her baby had already been adopted. But no one would confirm or deny that was the case. Thinking it was already gone kept her from going mad in that place. Had you any idea who did this back then?
Sure, how would I know, Inspector?
O'Malley said. Maybe the priest? Or that Brian fella? After all, it was Sally who shoved the apple into his mouth.
Anyway, I don't know.
The terrible thing is, they blamed it on another boy. A red-headed whippet tearaway. Younger than us he was.
Who was he?
Can't remember. My head is a bit addled with the drink, you know.
He pointed to a patch of skin just below his eye. But I do remember him sticking a fork in my face one time. Could have blinded me. But for some reason, we became something like friends. Not real friends. Respect for each other, maybe. Hard to explain. O'Malley stared at a point in the wall above Lottie's head. Poor bastard. Lottie's brain was swimming with all this new information. They killed him too. O'Malley's voice was soft in the silence.
What do you mean? Who killed who? When?
Lottie asked, confusion constricting her thought process.
It was months later.
Winter time. Fierce cold it was. Beaten to a pulp he was. Buried him beside the baby in the orchard. O'Malley's head sank into his chest. Lottie wondered for a moment if he was making it all up. But she concluded the man was too distraught to do that. What had gone on in that place? Who murdered the baby and who murdered this nameless boy? Who was the baby? Was it Susan's? A flood of questions crackled at the tip of her tongue without being spoken. She watched O'Malley, his eyes boring a hole through the wall, and she knew he had said all he had to say. He moved his head and looked at her, and she felt his deep brown eyes peer into the back of her skull. "We used to call it the night of the black moon," he said.
"The black moon?" said Boyd. "I think I've heard of that."
"I can tell you, we might have been afraid before that boy was killed, but it was nothing to the fear we carried around with us after that."
"And you don't know who he was?" Lottie asked again. He shook his head.
"Must have blocked it out."
"If it comes back to you, let me know." Conundrum time. She glanced at Boyd. He looked as stymied as she felt. O'Malley gave her a tired nod. She glanced down at the name she'd scribbled on her pad. "Do you know where this Father Con is now?"
"I hope he's dead."
"And Brian, do you know what happened to him?"
"I never liked him. I always had my suspicions about him and the dead baby. So I hope he's dead too."
Lottie stood beside Boyd outside the station door watching the hunched O'Malley shuffle through the snow on his way down the street. Boyd lit a cigarette. Lottie took it from him. She inhaled and he sparked up another for himself.
"That was some hellhole," she said.
"St. Angela's?"
"Yeah. Jesus, how many lives did it wreck?
You only have to look at Patrick O'Malley. The poor shite." "And how many more are there out there like him?" Lottie asked. "I think Susan Sullivan was haunted all her life by her experiences, and probably Brown too. But at last I'm convinced there's more to this case than planning permission."
"You're sure their past is a factor?" asked Boyd.
"Of course it is." Lottie was adamant.
She knew Boyd wasn't convinced. He said, two apparent murders almost 40 years ago. I can't see how they can be linked to the murders we have now. I can't either. Not at the moment. Lottie stamped out a cigarette. I wonder who this Father Con is and where he is, Boyd said. In jail, if he's lucky. I'll run his name through Pulse and see what turns up, said Boyd. But without a full name, I don't hold much hope. Find out what you can about that soup kitchen too, Lottie said. Is this O'Malley a suspect? God help him, but he has to be in the frame, somewhere. He's linked to Brown and Sullivan through their shared past. We better keep an eye on him. I don't think he could be sober long enough to kill anyone. Boyd attempted to blow smoke rings, but they died in the air. And he'd leave a trail of skin behind him to fill every forensic lab in the country. Lottie glanced towards the cathedral and jumped as the bells rang out 10 chimes. I'm going to visit our developer friend, Tom Ricard, she said. Shake his tree and see what falls out, said Boyd, dousing his cigarette in the snow. And I'll have to find out how Bishop Connor fits into all this. Ask your priest when you find him.
Who?
Don't act all innocent with me, Lottie Parker. I think you've taken a shine to Father Joe. Your imagination is so vivid, Boyd, it's blinding me. Lottie zipped her jacket and hurried down the street before Boyd could see the flush on her cheeks.
Chapter 50 Tom Ricard was letting her know he was busy, rattling desk drawers, stacking files in front of him and tapping his keyboard simultaneously. His eyes appeared closer together, scrunched in a scowl. I can do without your interruptions, he said, shuffling out of his suit jacket. He rolled his shirt sleeves, slowly and methodically, up to his elbows. Ready for battle, Lottie surmised, wondering how he had ever spawned a son. Then again, he was a rich bastard. Sometimes money could compensate. Why did you buy St. Angela's? She asked without any preamble. She had caught him on his way into work, hoping that he might have a hangover, like almost everyone else she'd encountered this morning. He wasn't impressed with being door-stopped. Reluctantly, he had allowed her a few minutes of his precious time. That's none of your business. Ricard ceased fidgeting. I have two murder victims, both of whom worked on the planning application for the property you bought from Bishop Connor. I also have a dead priest. And you tell me it's none of my business? It's simple, he said. I bought St. Angela's because I happen to believe it's a prime site for development. I've sunk a lot of money into this project and I stand to make profits from it in the future. I don't appreciate you getting involved in my business affairs. He gave the drawer one last thump and folded his arms. It is my business, if it helps me find a murderer. Lottie paused for effect. Tell me, why did James Brown contact you after Susan Sullivan was murdered? Are you deaf? I've already told you I didn't speak with him. The call lasted 37 seconds, Lottie persisted. You can say a lot in 37 seconds. I did not speak with the man, Ricard said, his voice slow and determined, his veneers flashing. Maybe it went to voicemail. Did you check? I did not speak with him, he said, a snarl curving his mouth upwards. How much did St. Angela's cost you? Lottie changed tack. That's definitely none of your business, Ricard said, unfolding his arms and thumping his desk. Lottie smiled. Shaking the tree was working. Mr. Ricard, I've discovered you purchased St. Angela's for no more than half its market value. Bea Walsh had supplied Lottie with this news. That information might interest the financial gurus in the Vatican. I hear they're hard up for funds. What do you think? I think you're out of your depth, Inspector. It's of no concern to anyone how much I paid for that property. His nostrils flared like an enraged bull.
I don't see how this has anything to do with your investigations.
His face was getting redder by the second. I beg